This is side one of tape four of the continuation of the oral history interview with Emeritus Professor of Italian Robert Rodini, April 27th, 2006. You were just beginning to talk about the tenure process at the divisional committee level.
The divisional committee would meet, and at each meeting a particular case was assigned to be discussed. Sometimes there would be two, but that was rather rare. This committee, as opposed to the graduate school committee for research funding that I was talking about earlier, tended to be much more divisive, because here we were talking about tenure and keeping someone on the faculty, and people had very strong opinions about the research of individuals, and paid very close attention to the reports of the two people in charge of that particular tenure case, making sure that they were convinced that the scholarship was solid, that it was something deserving of promotion, and that there had been enough scholarship produced. That was a very, very problematic issue, because the college tried as best as it could to make it very clear what was expected in order to get tenure. And many departments, and my department included, set up a mentoring system whereby any young person who came into the department as an assistant professor was assigned a mentor who was chair of a committee who periodically, a committee which periodically reviewed what that person was doing, so the department could keep the person on track and counsel him or her so that there was not a big surprise when it came to a tenure decision. So they were told very bluntly, unless you finish that book, your chances with the divisional committee are very, very slim. So I say that only because I know so many people who teach at other universities where everything is very, very vague. No one ever knows exactly what is expected. But at least in the College of Letters and Science here, and I can't speak for other units of the university, people generally knew by, let's see, the 90s, that the late 90s, that two books were expected and a decent number of articles. When I came up for tenure 20 years earlier, not that much was expected. Mm-hmm. So the divisional committee at its meeting would really interrogate the interviewer or the interview, two interviewers, regarding the case, trying to make sure that that their decision was valid if they were recommending. The committee, the interviewing committee, could of course not recommend the person, and that happened at times too.
If someone were a candidate for tenure, as I understand it, the process was a recommendation came from the department.
That's right.
And if the recommendation from the department were unanimous, did that generally foreshadow that tenure would probably guaranteed be to be awarded?
Not necessarily, no. Oh. There were especially with smaller departments. years, where the tendency would be for unanimity of the faculty. Let's say there's a department that had 4 or 5 faculty members, understandably, the department wanted, unless the person were completely unproductive, wanted to keep its faculty and did not want to lose someone, because losing someone meant that you then had to struggle to get a replacement, which has never been easy. So you had to keep that into account, that they could have been doing it to for reasons that were other than concerned with the quality of the person's work. Now, what constituted, of course, in the eyes of the faculty of the department, what constituted productivity was often completely different from the divisional committee's concept of what constituted productivity. Let me give you two examples. Let's say that, generally speaking, the divisional committee took into account publications, teaching, and service. Well, everyone knew very well that this was a very nice idea, but it was really publications that counted. I mean, often you get a top-notch teacher who was known throughout the campus, and that would carry a lot of weight. But the person who was a very good teacher and had an excellent record, and who hadn't published anything, the weight was going to, how shall I put it, the fact that he or she had not published much was going to count against him. Well, if you went to the School of Music, or you went to the art department, what do you do? I mean, a musician is not going to publish. Mm-hmm. Normally, is not going to publish. But that was expected, and some people thought that was a ridiculous idea. Why should a clarinetist have to publish? Well, it turned out that I mentioned a clarinetist because I happened to get a case of a clarinetist, and this clarinetist produced a book on how to make reeds for the clarinet. And it was very, very clear to me that he had done it because it was something on paper that he could show as a publication. But obviously, for his department, what was important was the fact that he was an excellent clarinetist. And as a matter of fact, he got tenure, and he's now in the Madison Symphony. You know, I think he's first clarinetist in the Madison Symphony. I'm not sure of that, but I think so. So you had that sort of thing. And of course, you can imagine in the art department,
right.
you have, it's a very subjective sort of thing. You know, you could look at something, let's say, a Dali-like work that some people might love and other people might hate,
yes.
And then who decides whether it is valuable or worth tenure? Mm-hmm. I mean, it becomes very tricky at times. Mm-hmm. So then the divisional committee takes a vote. I can't remember exactly how the voting was a paper ballot. I can't.
Oh, it was.
Yes, it was a paper ballot, and if the vote was negative, and I can't remember what the percentage of the vote had to be positive or negative, but if tenure was voted down, then of course the department and the individual concerned had a right to appeal. Well, the divisional committee's recommendation for tenure against tenure went to the dean. The dean then made the decision, and if the decision was not to grant tenure, the department could appeal, and then it would come back to the divisional committee, and the divisional committee would reconsider.
So if the divisional committee denied tenure, and the dean accepted that recommendation, and so a professor ended up not having tenure, the professor could then bring that back to the divisional committee?
Correct.
And you could then overrule the dean?
I'm afraid I can't answer that question. Okay. I don't remember, while I was on the committee, that such a case came up. And if it did, I don't recall exactly how it was resolved.
As you think back on your work at the divisional committee, are you pleased with the way tenure has been managed at the university?
In most cases, yes. I do think that a number of people, when I was on the committee, slipped through the cracks because I don't think enough was known about the type of work the individual did. And it was a matter of granting tenure because no one could really come up with a reason not to, but no one was really convinced that the work was really top-notch. Let's say, for example, you had someone in the East Asian Language Department who essentially did translations. Mm-hmm. You had to rely on letters from the outside because no one on the committee was capable of making judgments about the quality of the translation, the importance of the translation, etc. So there were cases, I must admit, there were cases when tenure was granted, I think, because the individual was sort of a token person on campus. He or she was the only one who did that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And whether it was as outstanding as what might have been done by someone in the history department or the English department was open to debate, but it was a person who was sort of unique in one way or another. I'm not sure if that's terribly clear.
I can
think of a case or two which I'd rather not go on record about, but they would fit into the category of being token types, and
it's very clear, and tenure is a big part of these discussions because mm-hmm. it's central to the life of the university. A number of your peers that I have talked to have said, and I'm interested in your observations, that the way tenure was granted in the period from 1950 to 2000 seemed to change dramatically, that it was much more casual, they thought, and has become much more stressful for younger faculty, and there is much more focus on getting tenure than was the case earlier. And I'm wondering if what your experience was with that.
Oh, I agree entirely. I wasn't on the divisional committee when tenure became as difficult to get as it is now, and it has been in the last 10 years, I think. But just from an outsider's point of view, I mean, as being a faculty member of a department, I know that the anxiety and the tension, etc., is much greater than it was when I came up for tenure, where it almost became automatic. If you had a book, if you had a good teaching record, if you had done university service, that was really pretty much all that was required. Now it's sort of taken for granted that you have to have two books. And that is very difficult, as you can imagine, because just getting a book published these days is a near impossibility. The university presses are going down the drain. They have no funding. Wisconsin is a good example. University Press is more and more only going to publish books that they know will sell, whereas when I was young, they published scholarly works that they knew wouldn't sell, but they thought were worth publishing. But now presses can't afford to take those chances. So they go after things that are going to be marketable. The University of Wisconsin's press on gay men in Iowa, for example, became sort of a best seller. Oh, it wasn't a particularly scholarly book, but it was a book of great interest to the book market. And that person was not had nothing to do with a tenure case. He was not on the faculty, if I'm mistaken. But that's just an example of how difficult it is to sell a scholarly book to a press, and therefore to get tenure.
And so then my question to you is the tenure process today useful? Is it getting the same quality of professors as when you... I mean, the ones that I'm talking to now who got tenure in the 50s, 60s, 70s are really stellar intellects, leaders in their field nationally. And they generally don't seem to remember tenure as an anguishing process. Mm-hmm. What I hear today is that it is sort of anguishing. And is that an improvement?
Well, it's anguishing, but on the other hand, you would find if you took Department A, for example, let's say it's a large department, and you ask of each of them the same question you're asking me about recent tenure cases, I am sure that there would be a great split. That there would be those traditional scholars to whom you're referring, who got tenure in the 60s, 70s, the early 80s, who would say that individuals have been given tenure. Yes, it's been sort of a period of anxiety, et cetera, for them, but they've been given tenure. But are in areas that are completely peripheral to what the department thinks is important, very much faddish type of work, pop culture, for example, which a lot of people just sort of turn their nose up at. I don't have an opinion one way or the other. I did belong to the popular culture, the popular culture organization, and gave a few papers in on pop culture, but that's another matter. But they think people are getting tenure in areas that are really not legitimate scholarly areas. Uh-huh. So it's sort of a paradoxical situation. It's much more difficult to come by it, but a lot of people seem to get it only because they represent a certain new fad. So for a while you could say feminist criticism, but now feminist criticism is sort of a part of the curriculum. It's just taken for granted, but Indian language studies or comic strip maps as literature, that sort of thing. I'm just making this up, but I think the idea is fairly clear.
You know, periodically, tenure denial cases hit the papers in Madison. And, you know, a professor is denied tenure. And, of course, to the average person, you know, you have no way of evaluating that. Was it your experience generally that denial of tenure was appropriate when the divisional committee or the respective dean denied tenure?
Yes, I think in most instances. Sometimes it was a hard fight. I don't want to get away from your question, but sometimes it was a very hard fight, and it gets back to something I alluded to much earlier on. I had a 10-year case in which I had to present a poet. And if my memory serves me correctly, there were not many people on the divisional committee who were particularly interested in or knowledgeable about poetry. And here we were not talking about someone who was working on the poetry of Shakespeare or John Donne. We're talking about someone who was writing poetry. The irony was that his department had hired him to teach writing and teach the writing of poetry, and he was a very productive poet. So when Ron Wallace came up for tenure, and I was in charge of his case, I had to make a case for him. And I didn't know exactly how to go about it, but I decided that I was so much taken by his poetry, which in his younger period, and I think has continued this way, even though I haven't followed Ron Wallace's career, it was so much dealt with his relationship with his father, and I read an absolutely beautiful poem that he wrote that was inspired by his father, and I think I used all the drama I had in me, and he was granted tenure without any discussion. I think it was either because people were moved by the poem or they had no way of judging, and they thought, well, if this is a man who's talking to us who works with poetry, uh-huh. and he thinks that this is very good, fine. And Ron Wallace got tenure, and he has since, of course, become a very well-known poet.
What is interesting, aside from your work on getting Ron tenure, is what you went on to say about the precedent that that has set for other creative writers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the whole issue of what you were talking about with the School of Music and the Art Department, how do you evaluate the creative, the artistic creative process?
Well, it's very unfortunate that there are many sort of paradoxical situations in, I suppose, all fields, but in the College of Letters and Science, particularly, it seems to me, in that, for example, departments like the Department of French and Italian, the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, the Department of German, will hire people as language coordinators or people who are specialists in foreign language pedagogy. But then when it comes to tenure cases involving these people, the divisional committee tended to look upon the case as very, I don't want to say suspicious, but is this really scholarship? But yet they hired these people, and they needed these people, and these people had doctorates in the field of foreign language pedagogy. And their graduate students went out and got jobs because they had been so well trained. Connie Knope, for example, who is internationally known as a pedagogue in, as far as teaching French goes. She got tenure without any difficulty, I'm sure. But people who are hired in similar situations, that is to teach people how to teach languages, had a very difficult time getting tenure, or didn't get it at all. There was someone in the German department who was top-notch and did not get tenure because it was at the time when the divisional committee did not think that that was something worth granting tenure for, even though he was hired to do and did exactly what he was hired to do.
Now that leads me to ask you about the dean, whoever the dean was. The dean has a very critical role here.
He does, and I have no idea who the dean was at the time.
But what I wanted to ask you was, generally, was the relationship between the divisional committee and the dean a healthy one?
I think so. I think that the dean that I worked under, if I can put it that way, for the longest period of time was David Cronin, and David Cronin was a very serious historian, and his son, as you know, has followed in his footsteps. I can understand that they might have some question, I shouldn't say they, that a scholar of that sort might have some sort of question about someone who teaches people how to teach languages. But on the other hand, they knew that it was a very important hire for the department, especially with all these teaching assistants who were teaching hundreds of students languages, and they were getting very good direction from people who were very, very creative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Are you glad that you served on the divisional committee?
Oh, yes. I never regretted it. Mm-hmm.
It does sound...
Especially when it comes to a case like the Ron Wallace case.
Yes, well, I that's true. You do have some power,
mm-hmm,
and some influence, mm-hmm, to affect certain things. How big was the committee?
Oh, I can't remember exactly. I think we were about 10.
Mm-hmm. And did all the tenure cases come up at one time, like... At your big spring meeting, did you evaluate all the tenure requests, or was it throughout the year?
You know, it was spread throughout the spring semester.
Throughout the spring semester.
Because the committee members had to have time to interview the candidate and to prepare their case, etc. So I would say within a 2-month span, we had to do all the cases.
So in that sense, you were, because of the close proximity, generally able to apply the same standards. You would make reference to, well, we just did candidate A, and now we're doing candidate B. And,
mm-hmm. Of course, you were often discussing people who did entirely different kinds of things.
Yes.
Yeah.
But again, this divisional committee for the entire College of Letters and Science, or just the humanities?
The entire college. Yes, it was the entire college, because we would have people from textile and design, for example.
Or you would have math or sociology?
No. Math and sociology, I'm sure, were in a different division or on different, handled by a different committee.
Okay, but your divisional committee would span all the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. This concludes side one of tape 4. This is side 2 of tape 4, April 27th, 2006. Emeritus Professor of Italian, Robert Rodini. Rob, another part of university service, of course, involves the whole concept of faculty governance at the university. And I see that you were in the Faculty Senate twice, once in the 70s and once in the 80s. And I'm interested in your observations about faculty governance here and what your service in the Senate was like.
I think I had a rather jaded opinion as to how effective the Faculty Senate was and the way it worked. In such a large group of people, there were always, in my experience, there are always a couple who dominated the discussion. We're talking about a group of 150 people, mm-hmm. and who dominated the discussion. So I think that often people shied away from serving on that committee because they felt that their voice was not heard, and that either a very conservative or a very radical a group of people did all the talking, and the middle of the road people were very silent. And I found that in general the meetings were unproductive and led to a lot of bickering. So I must say that it was one of the committees that I least enjoyed being on.
And how did you get in there? Were you elected?
I was elected.
By your department?
You're elected by the department. Right.
I see. So every department had somebody.
Every department had somebody, and to be perfectly frank, it was often very difficult for departments to get someone to serve on the Faculty Senate because they felt that it took time and their voice was not heard and not much was accomplished. Mm-hmm. So in my experience, working on the divisional committee, the graduate school research committee was very enjoyable, and I felt that something important came out of it. I think that the Faculty Senate tends to be unproductive in many respects. Mm-hmm.
Generally, though, would you say that faculty governance has served faculty and the university well?
I think so. I certainly think that the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee has been very important, especially recently in the various cases that have caused such concern with the community as a whole. And I think the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee, under Jim Connolly especially, for whom I have the greatest respect, as chair of the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee, they've done an excellent job in being very judicious and very fair. And of course, their decisions on cases are not always accepted by the chancellor, but I think that it's a very important committee signaling the voice that's given to the faculty, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in cases that are very, very, at times very dramatic and very difficult.
Yeah, certainly this last slew of concerning the
last
for the record,
three or four
the felons,
years. Yes, right.
A difficult time. Mm-hmm. How was it that you became such an active university citizen?
I have the slightest idea. I think that A, I did my job well. be the more that you do, the more that is asked of you, as someone who now is a volunteer, that has only confirmed my feelings, I tend to be very organized, and I tend to be very easy to get along with, but stand firm in my opinions. So I think that was respected by people like David Cronin and David Ward and John Wiley and Donna Shalala. Therefore, I was constantly during my career appointed to one committee or another.
Well, I just noticed you have quite a long list of university service, longer than many of the folks that I'm talking to, and so I was again interested for the record on how that happened. And I take it you did not see it as interference with your research or teaching life.
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's one of those cases in which the more one does, the more one gets accomplished. Somehow, I mean, I don't recall that I felt that it interfered in any way. And some of the committees, like the divisional committee and the research committee, did take a lot of time. But I didn't feel that it was detracting from my other work.
The area I want to turn to now, you've already given me a natural segue to, which is your evaluation of the various chancellors you've served under. And the chancellors have, of course, a very major role in the standing and the presence of the university. So we'd be interested to know your observations on, you were here certainly during Irving Shane and Donna Shalala, and then David Ward and John Wiley. Any observations for the record about what you thought they brought to the university, consequences of their respective styles, would be important to hear.
Well, going back into really my youth as a faculty member, I recall having great respect for Irving Shane because I thought he was a very judicious, very fair, very, how shall I put it, very thoughtful administrator. I enjoyed working under Donna Shalala, but of course she was an entirely different type of person. She appointed me to her advisory council, which I enjoyed serving on. But I enjoyed serving on it especially because it gave me a chance to get to know her, and it revealed her personality and her great strengths. But it also revealed what some people didn't like about Donna Shalala. I mean, the Donna Shalala could be very hard-nosed, and you often wondered whether she took any of the advisory committee's advice or not. And
what was it? I've never heard of the advisory committee before.
I don't think it exists anymore. I think it was something that she created.
What was it?
Ex nihilo. It was a group of faculty members who would meet not terribly frequently to discuss major financial issues, general university issues that she thought she should get some input on. I can't remember anyone in particular. I think I can't remember anyone in particular because I wasn't sure there was too much discussion. I enjoyed working under her, but she was completely different from Irving Shane and the way that he handled things. But at the time that Irving Shane was chancellor, I was not very active in committees.
How did you end up on Donna's committee?
I haven't the slightest idea. I was asked by her personally in a letter to serve on the committee. And I said, I can't pass this up. But I have I haven't the slightest idea why I was on the committee.
Tell me a little more about that committee. Who were the other members? Did Donna even come to the meetings?
Oh, yes. No, Donna was very serious about it, and she had an agenda, and I think the committee consisted of not only the chancellor, but the graduate school dean, and the dean of humanities, the dean of the medical school. So there were several administrative types, as well as faculty members. I can't recall that we had a lot of discussion on issues, nor can I recall that the meetings were terribly long. So one might say that it was pro forma to a certain degree. I think I'm right in saying that. Maybe she did get some ideas from us, I don't recall, but she was usually fairly firm in her own convictions. And
isn't that a bit of an understatement?
Yes, a bit of an understatement. And the committee didn't, the committee seemed to sort of fade away after a while. And as I say, I don't think it exists anymore.
I get the sense, though, that you had respect for Donna.
Yes, I had respect for her. I didn't always agree with certain certain views she had on political issues, but I had respect for, especially a woman who came into a very high position and didn't let anyone sort of ride over her. I mean, she really stuck by her guns. Of course, as you know, she was disliked by many people. To put it mildly, the name sent shivers down some people's spine. But by and large, I respected her capabilities and her talents. I didn't always agree with her political views.
Was she a good chancellor for the university?
Yeah, I think that if you ask people to recall chancellors of the university, she's one of the first people who comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's for the wrong reasons. Maybe because she was a chancellor who was so into sports. Yes. And gave the athletic department such a high profile, which is something I didn't agree with at all. I mean, I didn't see why the athletic department should be treated any more favorably than other departments, which I thought were much more important to a university. Mm-hmm. I did respect her for the clever way in which she handled that whole situation.
My sense is that during the Shalala years were really before I was involved, that she would have been the subject of intense conversation at gatherings of faculty, that she was a major presence.
Oh, she always was, yes, yeah. But she could be very, very cordial. I remember being on many plane trips with her. We didn't travel together, but happened to be sitting next to each other on a plane coming back from a meeting or something of that sort. And she was very cordial and very interested in what I was doing. And she was a very good PR person.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You're right. There are a wide variety of opinions. You know better than I. Moving on to David Ward, then, as chancellor.
Well, let's say initially I thought your report was excellent. I haven't agreed with much of, or many of his positions in the later years of his reign, if put it that way, nor with John Wiley's. I very much liked working under David when he was graduate school dean, and I very much liked working with John Wiley. But I think they have both, on one occasion or another, gotten into very difficult political situations.
Rob, can you elaborate with either, or perhaps with John Wiley, the kind of situation that you're talking about?
Well, I think initially with both David Ward and John Wiley, I felt that there was a great amount of empathy with both the students and individual faculty members. But I've been very concerned of late with moves such as John Wiley's in regard to funding for the Catholic organization on campus, and the whole argument about whether the university should be funding a religious organization for certain of their activities, which he says, well, he is following the correct political procedure. I mean, the separation, of course, of the church and the state, if you want to put it in those terms. But I ask myself what the motive is, really. I mean, why at this point is he getting himself involved in something that he could have gotten involved in years ago, and or the administration could have gotten involved in? Why suddenly does it become a major problem? It seems to me that people like John Wiley, and perhaps this is only, it comes with the territory, are very, very concerned about what the community as a whole thinks. And of course they have to be, but I'm not sure that this is the way it should be handled.
Rob, as you look at your close to 40 years at the university, you've seen generations of students come and go, and you've seen the university develop and change. Do you have any observations for the historical record over the nature of the change, your perception on what role the university will have in the future in the state, what the role of the university will be, what the students will be like?
Well, I've only been associated with two universities, and both of them major universities, University of California and the University of Wisconsin. And therefore, I really don't know much about the dynamics of smaller institutions. I've always been one of the little fish in a very, very big pond. And comparing the two, I've always felt from the very beginning of my career here that Wisconsin was, in spite of all the problems, the bombing of Sterling Hall, the anti-war protests, the various TA strikes, etc., that Wisconsin was by and large, has been by and large, faculty, administrators included, been very, very attentive to student concerns. Sometimes they have been too tolerant of what goes on with the students. I think such things as the Mifflin Street Party and such activities of that sort could have been taken care of a long time ago, would have, I don't know, solved many problems, but would have been, let's say, would have nipped things in the bud. But I think that by and large, the university, as compared to the university where I went to school and where I got my graduate degree, which seemed to me to be, and I think it was falling in the footsteps of the Ivy League schools on the East Coast, because Berkeley does consider itself second best, if not better than Harvard. It was a school that, from the undergraduate students through the whole graduate program, seemed to be indifferent to their students. Obviously, they had excellent faculty, but the faculty seemed to be more concerned about its career than with really nurturing the students in the way that I found has not been the case at Wisconsin. I found that almost everyone I know here at Wisconsin is very much involved with the students, at least in my area, the humanities. And so if the university can continue its mission in that way, I think it'll continue to grow as a major institution. It's just unfortunate that it has had to go through a period of such bad PR in the newspapers, locally and nationally, because of some very misguided steps that have been taken by the administration. Legally and otherwise. So in the long run, and sort of by way of conclusion on this topic, I think the University of Wisconsin is someplace that one can still be very proud of, and just hopes that it manages to extricate itself from some of the damaging events that have taken place recently, in part due to the fault of the administration, and
Rob, now you are no longer Professor Rodini at the Department of French and Italian at the university, and you have really developed quite an active life in the community. I'm interested in how you made that switch and why you seem to have left academe so abruptly or so cleanly and moved into the area of healthcare.
What happened, first of all, was that a few years before I retired from the university, I decided that I wanted to do some sort of volunteer work that involved the community and not to pay back a debt I owe the community. I've never been able to stand that idea that there's something that I owed that I had to pay back. But what I was very interested in doing was getting into something completely different from what I had been doing in the past. I didn't feel like writing another article. I didn't see that there was any point in my writing another article. I mean, too many articles are written that people don't read, and I thought that I could do something much more productive than that. And so before I retired, a number of years before I retired, I started volunteering at Meritor Hospital, which is now, of course, affiliated with UW Hospital. And I did that for one particular reason. I was interested in, if I were going to do anything at all, something that had to do with public health. And perhaps this goes back to my original idea of becoming a doctor or a dentist. And maybe I was trying to convert that PhD to an MD. After all, we're, if I'm a doctor, I could pass for one or the other, I say jokingly. So I started working at Meritor. The hospital wanted to take full advantage of my background, so they thought that I would be great as a lecturer, and they decided that if I were to do something, go out on the sort of lecture circuit for the organization Men Against Rape, that would be great. And I said no, I didn't feel like lecturing. I had done that most of my life. Then they decided at Meritor Hospital that I would be very good as a researcher in the medical school library for doctors who needed something done. And I said no, I had worked with computers research materials enough. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be with the public. So what happened eventually is that I became a sort of liaison person between the hospital and the patients. That is to say, I would visit the patients after they were admitted, and I would act as an intermediary between the patient and the hospital administration. If the patient had problems, had questions, I would help them. And then I ended up eventually, after having gone to Europe, coming back and deciding that that is not really what I wanted to do, I ended up working at the information desks, which I love doing, and my wife, who is a retired reference librarian, jokingly says that I do exactly the same kind of work that she did when she was employed by the university as a reference librarian. That is to say, answering difficult questions. My questions are not quite as difficult as hers were. Then the inevitable happened. Having thought that I would never serve on another committee, I was asked to be on the Board of Trustees of the Friends of Meritor, which is a collateral Board of Trustees, the medical board on one side and the Friends of Meritor on the other, which includes the foundation that raises money for the hospital, a committee that raises money for scholarships for high school students who are going into public health. And I agreed to serve on the Board of Trustees, and again, the inevitable happened. I got appointed as president of the Board of Trustees, and enjoyed doing that, not half as much as doing the actual volunteer work, because it was committee work again. And I recently retired from that position, and I'm back as a menial volunteer. And the big joke is, why would a college or university professor do anything as menial as working at a desk in the hospital? I said, because I enjoy it. And it's a great pleasure, and I meet people, and I help people in a different way.
And you don't have to bring the dissertations or the blue books home, too.
Exactly. There's absolutely nothing I have to bring home with me. But I can just take off.
Okay. This concludes side two of tape four. This is tape number five, side one of the ongoing oral history interview with Emeritus Professor of Italian Robert Rudini on April 27th, 2006. Rob, you were just talking about your service at Meritor, and I have to agree with all those people who are a little amazed that a college professor is working the information desk, particularly someone who was in your subject as distinguished as you were.
Well, yeah, that's a very natural question, I think, and it comes up very frequently. I decided, I don't remember it's being a very conscious decision, but somehow or another, I felt that writing another article or two, or continuing what I had been doing for 30 some years, was not going to bring me any great satisfaction. Anything that one in my field publishes has a very, very limited audience, and I thought I'd prefer to do something that would be generally more helpful and more satisfying to me than sitting in my study and writing. But when I look back upon my career, which of course I do, I think there are two things that give me the greatest amount of satisfaction. First, and I've mentioned this I think at times during the course of this interview, probably the greatest satisfaction is the fact that I have so many graduate students throughout the country who have become very well known to distinguished scholars in their own right. That is enhanced by the fact that so many of them have followed in my footsteps in their areas of interest, especially in gender studies, in feminist theory, in the relationship between literature and art history. So even if they had not written their dissertation under my direction, many of them have continued to teach in the area that they were exposed to in my classes. So that's probably the greatest satisfaction I have in looking back upon my career. And that is seconded by the fact that many of them have remained friends of mine, and I see them quite often and whenever possible. The other great highlight of the end of my career was a major surprise to me. I still cannot believe that it happened. I was invited to become honorary president of an organization in my field, which is based in Ottawa, Canada. And about 2 years ago, I went to a meeting of the organization and was asked if I would be honorary president. And I said I'd be more than happy to. And I went to Ottawa and had a very nice vacation. And there was a banquet. And at the banquet, three people were called upon to get up and speak. And I could not, sitting in the audience, I could not figure out why these three particular individuals, all three of whom I knew very well, were being asked to get up and go to the podium, because they had nothing relevant to do with the conference. Well, it turned out that they were three people who had for a good 4 or 5 years been working on a collection of essays, a Festschrift in my honor, which they presented to me a while at the podium. And and I was overwhelmed, because dozens of my former students had come to this meeting in Ottawa for no other reason than to be present at the presentation of this collection of essays, which is called the Medusa's Gaze. I wrote an article on the gaze in Michelangelo's poetry, and I think the title in some ways was inspired by that article. And the wonderful thing about that collection of essays is the fact that it contains not only essays of many of my former students, but also an essay by my thesis director. And I'll just finish the interview by saying that he was probably the most influential man in my academic career, Nicholas Perella, who is an emeritus professor from the University of California, Berkeley. And I think I was most moved by two contributions. By his contribution to think that a man of his age would have the time and the willingness to write an essay for his, turns out, very first graduate student. And the other person who, in addition to all my students who contributed to the volume, the other essay was written by a former faculty member of the English department here at the University of Wisconsin, Raymond Waddington, who is now the head of graduate studies at the University of California, Davis, who became interested in things Italian, and I think due in part to the fact of his acquaintance with me. So it was really probably the one most wonderful thing that I can remember happening to me in my life, and fortunately I was in health, good enough health, that I did not have a coronary on the spot.
It clearly was an appropriate honor for the distinguished Professor Robert Rodini. So it is has been a privilege to have this interview, and the archives of the University of Wisconsin-Madison are richer for it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.